I have nothing to say.
But you are in grave danger, Mr. Inglethorpe. You are accused of murdering your wife, and these gentlemen have come from Scotland Yard.
Afternoon, Mr. Inglethorpe.
Will you not say where you were at 6 o'clock on Monday?
I will not. The accusation is monstrous.
Mr. Inglethorpe, I must warn you.
A moment, I beg you, Inspector. If Mr. Inglethorpe will not tell you, then I must speak for him.
How can you speak? You do not know.
The man who purchased strychnine at the chemist's shop cannot have been Mr. Inglethorpe, because at 6 o'clock on that day, he was escorting Mrs. Rakes back to her home at Abbey Farm. I can produce at least 5 witnesses who will swear they saw them together.
You really are the goods and no mistake. I'm much obliged to you, Monsieur Poirot.
But if that's the case, Mr. Inglethorpe, why on earth couldn't you say this at the inquest?
Because a most malicious rumour had been spread about me. And with my poor Emily not yet buried. Can you wonder I was anxious that no more lying rumours were started?
Between you and me, sir, I'd sooner have any amount of tales about me than be arrested for murder. And if it hadn't been for Monsieur Poirot here, you would have been as sure as eggs is eggs. So, perhaps we could now take a look at the scene of the crime.
Quick, Hastings, go upstairs to the other wing. Stand there just this side of the baize door.
Right.
Do not move until I come.
And he followed the others upstairs. I went and took up my position and stood there for the next 20 minutes.
You have not left your post?
I have been here all the time. What exactly is this in aid of?
Did you perhaps hear a loud thump?
Nothing at all. Should I have done?
I have been very clumsy. I knocked over a table in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room.
I'm sure it's of no consequence. But I did remember something while I was standing there like an idiot. I should have told you before. Dr. Bauerstein was here on Tuesday night.
Huh? He was here on the night of the murder?
Yes, he took coffee with the rest of us.
Oh, but that changes everything. We must take Mr. Cavendish's car and go down to Tadminster at once.
So, now that Inglethorpe's out of the running, where do we go from here?
Is there no one you yourself suspect, mon ami?
Well, you'll probably think this far-fetched, but I can't help worrying about Evelyn Howard's fanatical hatred of Inglethorpe. You don't think she could have tried to poison him and that Mrs. Inglethorpe somehow got hold of it by mistake?
But Miss Howard had been away from Stiles for more than a week. It is hardly a very plausible theory.
So I suppose that leaves us with John and Lawrence. But I can hardly believe...
You did not think there was something rather strange about Lawrence's theory concerning his mother's tonic?
It was quite a reasonable suggestion for a layman.
But Lawrence Cavendish is not a layman. He is trained as a doctor. Why should he be the only one to suggest that his mother died of natural causes?
It is a bit odd, I admit.
And Mary Cavendish was certainly not telling all that she knew about the conversation she overheard. Is she trying to protect someone? Or is she perhaps trying to protect herself? Yeah, but here we are. There is something I must leave with the analytical chemist.
What?
A sample of the cocoa from the saucepan in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room.
But Dr. Bauerstein has already had it tested.
I know that, mon ami, but I have a fancy to have it analyzed again. And by the way, when you are next alone with Lawrence Cavendish, say to him, I have a message from Hercule Poirot. Find the extra coffee cup and you can rest in peace.
Needless to say, when I mentioned this to Lawrence, he hadn't the foggiest idea what I was talking about. The funeral of Mrs. Inglethorpe took place the following day, and to the great relief of all of us, her husband moved to the Stylites' Arms.
Excuse me, Captain Hastings.
Yes, Dorcas.
Will you be seeing the Belgian gentleman today?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm expecting him here any minute.
He was particularly inquiring about a green dress. He seemed to think it was important.
You mean you found it?
Well, no, sir, but I have just remembered the young gentleman used to have a dressing-up box, and all kinds of old cast-offs found their way into it. It occurred to me there might be a green dress in there. It's up in the front attic.
A crimson kimono, a cardboard breastplate, a very threadbare shooting jacket...
What about this scarf? Could it be what we're looking for?
No. Quite the wrong shade. We are not looking for emerald green.
Scabbard. bead necklace?
A blue cloak. Look at this, my friend.
Blackbeard.
And observe, Hastings. It has been trimmed to make it look like the beard worn by Inglethorpe.
A good place to hide it. Apart from Dorcas, the only people who appear to have known about the dressing up box are John and Lawrence.
And the beard is new. Everything else in the chest has been used over and over again, but this was obviously bought quite recently. I need someone to find out how it came here.
You could always ask John.
No, not John.
Miss Howard might know, or she could certainly find out.
An excellent idea. But I am in her black books because I prevented Inglethorpe being arrested. Can she be persuaded, I wonder?
Well, Monsieur Poirot, what do you want? Out with it. I'm busy.
Do you remember, mademoiselle, I once asked you to help me?
Yes, I do. And I told you I'd help you with pleasure to hang Inglethorpe.
Miss Howard, my friend Hastings told me of something you said that impressed me very much.
Well, what was that?
That if somebody close to you had been murdered, you would instantly know who had committed the crime.
And I suppose you think that's nonsense.
Not in the least.
And yet you don't believe me when I tell you it was Inglethorpe that killed poor Emily.
No, because you really do not believe that he did it. You are trying to shut out the name of the person your instinct tells you is the murderer.
No, that's not true.
I know you have too high a regard for justice to deceive yourself. Help me to unmask the real killer of your beloved Emily.
Yes, you are right. Nothing must be allowed to stand in the way of justice. Tell me what you want me to do.
Ah, Miss Murdoch, the very person I wanted to talk to. Monsieur Poirot wants to know if he can come and have a look round your dispensary.
Of course he can. But tell him I'm not there on Wednesdays. He's such a funny little man. The other day he made me take the brooch out of my tie and put it straight.
Yes, that kind of thing is rather an obsession with him.
Captain Hastings, you're always so kind and know such a lot. I want to ask your advice.
Go ahead.
You see, Aunt Emily always told me I should be provided for. I suppose she forgot or didn't think she would die so soon. But the long and short of it is, I'm not provided for. Do you think I ought to go away from here at once and stop living at Stiles?
Oh, good heavens, no. I'm sure they don't want to get rid of you.
Mrs. Cavendish does. She hates me. And so does he.
Oh, I'm quite sure you're wrong about Mary. And as for John...
Oh, I didn't mean John. I meant Lawrence. Not, of course, that I care whether he hates me or not. But he's been behaving so strangely lately and tries to avoid speaking to me. Rather horrid when no one loves you. I don't know what to do.
I know what you should do, Cynthia. Marry me.
Don't be silly.
I'm not being silly. I'm asking you to do me the honour of becoming my wife, Miss Murdoch.
You funny dear. It's perfectly sweet of you, but you know you don't really want to.
Yes, I do. And there's nothing to laugh at. I don't see anything funny about a proposal.
No, indeed. But next time, somebody might accept you. Good morning, Captain Hastings. And thank you. You've cheered me up very much.
Thinking over our little interview, it all struck me as being profoundly unsatisfactory. After lunch, I went for a stroll through the woods and sat down under an old beech tree trying to work out the whole mystery. In a couple of minutes, I was sound asleep.
It's no concern of yours, anyway.
John and Mary Cavendish were standing only a few feet away, totally unaware that I was there.
I won't have it, Mary. Do you understand?
You won't have it? What right do you think you have to criticise my conduct?
It's the talk of the village. My mother was buried only yesterday, and you spend all your time gadding about with that fellow.
Oh, well, if it's only village gossip you're worrying about...
You intend to go on seeing Bauerstein?
If I choose... I deny your right to criticise my actions. Do you think I don't know what you're up to?
What do you mean?
You know very well what I mean.
Mary, are you in love with this Bauerstein fellow?
Perhaps. But if I am, it is no concern of yours.
I stood there, not daring to make a move until Mary had gone. And then I stepped ostentatiously forward. John took it for granted that I'd only just come on the scene.
Oh, hello, Hastings. Have you been seeing the little fellow back to his cottage? Is he getting any further, do you think?
Well, if he is, he's keeping it to himself.
Well, is he really any good, do you think?
He was considered one of the finest detectives of his day.
Oh, it's all such a nightmare. Scotland Yard men in and out of the house all the time. They were there again this morning. Screaming headlines in every paper in the country. There was a whole crowd of journalists outside the lodge this morning. It's like being in an exhibit in the Chamber of Horrors. I don't know whether I shall ever be able to hold my head up again.
It'll pass. These things always do.
But who could have done it? It's horrible to think that now Inglethorpe's out of it, it can only be one of us.
But how could it be?
Well, that's just it. There isn't anyone.
You don't think...
Yes?
You don't think it could be Bauerstein?
But what possible interest could he have in Mother's death?
I've no idea, but Poirot got very excited when he heard Bauerstein had been at Stiles when the coffee was poured out. And then again, it might have been the cocoa. I know for a fact that Poirot is not at all happy about the analysis Bauerstein had carried out.
But cocoa couldn't have concealed the taste of strychnine.
We've only got Bauerstein's word for that. And after all, he knows more about poisons than anyone else in the country. He could have used something else.
Even so, I'm damned if I can see what his motive could have been. And in any case, he would have needed an accomplice.
John went off back towards the house. And then a terrible thought struck me. Could Bauerstein's accomplice have been Mary? Hadn't Mrs. Inglethorpe found out that she was having an affair with Bauerstein and threatened to tell John all about it? Was that why she'd been killed? Or had Mary cold-bloodedly used Bauerstein to get rid of a woman who was in her way?
Two married women shouldn't have to share the same house.
I must confess the whole idea made me feel rather sick. And I remembered what Mary had said on the very first afternoon we met.
Not in a case of poisoning. Isn't that supposed to be the woman's weapon?
I was in a very gloomy state of mind all the way back to Stiles. As I reached the garden, Evie came rushing towards me.
Captain, have you heard the news?
What news, Evie?
About Bauerstein.
What's happened to him?
He's been arrested.
Good Lord.
If you ask me, they've got the wrong black beard.
It does not surprise me. After all, we are only 4 miles from the coast.
What has that got to do with it?
Well, surely it is obvious, mon ami. Well,
no doubt I'm very dense, but I cannot see what the proximity of the coast has to do with the murder of Mrs. Inglethorpe.
Unless the good Inspector Japp has taken leave of his senses, the matter has nothing to do with Mrs. Inglethorpe.
Then why has Bauerstein been arrested?
For espionage, mon ami. What else?
You mean he's a German spy?
What, did you not suspect it?
The idea never entered my head.
It did not strike you as peculiar that a famous London doctor should bury himself in a little village like this and should be in the habit of walking about at all hours of the night?
You mean that's how he came to fall in the pond on the night of the murder?
It is very likely, mon ami. And he is, of course, a German by birth.
Oh, the blackguard.
No, not at all. He is, on the contrary, a patriot. And despite the fact that Belgium has been devastated by his fellow countrymen, I must confess, I rather admire his courage.
This is the man with whom Mary Cavendish has been wandering about all over the place.
Yes. I fancy he found her very useful. So long as everyone was gossiping about the pair of them, no one paid much attention to what Bauerstein was really doing.
Then, do you think he never really cared for her?
Oh, that I cannot say, but I will tell you one thing.
What's that?
I do not believe Mrs. Cavendish cares or has ever cared one jot about Dr. Bauerstein.
Do you really think that?
I'm quite sure of it. And I will tell you why.
Yes?
Because she cares for someone else.
What did he mean? I'm not a vain man where women are concerned, but in spite of myself, an agreeable warmth spread over me.
We must waste no more time and hurry on to the house. I have had a message from Miss Howard. She has discovered something.
Here you are, Monsieur Poirot. Is this what you were looking for?
I believe it is. Where did you find it, mademoiselle?
On top of a wardrobe. But I've no time to stand here chatting. Meeting of the Charities Committee at the Village Hall and Lady Tadminster's in the chair. Wouldn't do to keep her waiting.
Sheet of brown paper. Not very much to get excited about.
Ah, but do you not see the label?
Mrs. Parkson, theatrical costumiers. Is that what the beard came in?
So it would seem.
And it is addressed to, is it J. Cavendish or is it an L?
Well, it's certainly not a J. What was it doing on top of a wardrobe?
Ah, Monsieur Poirot. Nobody told me you were in the house. Good morning, Captain Hastings.
Good morning, Inspector.
What's that you got there? Theatrical costumiers, eh? Where did this come from?
Miss Howard found it on top of a wardrobe.
Hmm. Have you any objection to my hanging on to this, Monsieur Poirot?
None at all, Inspector. It has told me all I wish to know. How is the investigation progressing?
Oh, we've turned up a thing or two. As a matter of fact, we've come across another will.
A will?
Dated before Mrs. Inglethorpe's marriage, and leaving her entire fortune to Mr. Inglethorpe.
But why did her solicitor not know of this?
That's the funny thing about it. It was written on one of those printed will forms.
And where did you find it, Inspector?
In the desk in the boudoir.
But I understood that Mr. Wells had gone through all Mrs. Inglethorpe's papers very carefully.
You must have missed it. We found it stuffed into one of the drawers at the back. But I'd better be off, if you'll excuse me. Things are beginning to warm up. Goodbye, Mr. Poirot. Captain Hastings.
Goodbye, Inspector.
Ah, the poor chap. He has no method. Nevertheless, it is strange about the will. Ah, but here is the good Dorcas. A little word with you, Mademoiselle, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Poirot.
Tell me, on the day before the tragedy, did anything go wrong with Mrs. Inglethorpe's bell?
Oh, as a matter of fact, it did. Though I don't know how you came to hear of it. A mouse or some such must have nibbled the wire through. The man came and put it right on Tuesday.
Thank you, Mademoiselle. That is all I wanted to know.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Poirot.
One should never ask for outside proof. But the flesh is weak, and it is good to know one is on the right track. I am like a giant refreshed.
A very small giant.
Your little friend seems very pleased with himself. What's it all about?
I really haven't the faintest idea.
Is he quite mad?
I believe there's method in his madness.
Captain Hastings, I need to talk to you. Will you come into the garden?
Oh, of course, I'd be only too happy.
Tell me, do you think my husband and I are happy together?
I don't think it's any of my business to have an opinion.
Well, whether it's your business or not, I will tell you that we are not happy. You don't know anything about me, do you?
Well, no, not really.
My father was English, but my mother was Russian.
Ah, now I understand.
What do you understand?
Well, there's a hint of something rather different about you.
My mother was very beautiful, I believe. But she died when I was a little child. I was told she'd taken an overdose of sleeping pills by accident. My father was in the consular service. I went all over the world with him. It was a splendid life, and I loved it.
I can understand that.
And then my father died. He left me badly off, and I had to go and live with some old aunts in Yorkshire. The deadly monotony of life with them was getting too much for me, and then I met John. I wasn't in the least in love with him. I married him to get away from the terrible boredom of my existence.
I see.
Don't misunderstand me. I was quite honest with him. I told him that I liked him very much and that I hoped to come to like him more. I'm sure he cared for me at first, but we drifted apart. It is not a pleasant thing for me to admit, but he tired of me very soon.
Oh, but surely...
Not that it matters now. I believe we may have come to the parting of the ways. I'm not going to remain at Stiles.
And John?
I've no idea what he intends to do.
You're going to leave him?
I want to be free, Captain Hastings. You can have no idea what a prison this place has been to me.
I hope you won't do anything rash.
Rash?
You know that Dr. Bauerstein has been arrested.
My husband was so kind as to break the news to me this morning.
So, what do you think?
What should I think? Apparently he's a German spy, or so one of the gardeners told John. But I must go back to the house now. Thank you for listening to me so patiently.
Just before tea time, I went to look for Poirot and was told that he had gone to Cynthia Murdoch's dispensary. But he knew very well that Wednesday was her day off. What on earth was happening to the man?
I say, Hastings, if you happen to see your Belgian friend...
Yes, Lawrence?
Will you tell him I think I've found the extra coffee cup?
I must admit I've forgotten all about it. By the end of the afternoon, Poirot had returned. I found him sitting by the table in his cottage, his head buried in his hands.
Ah, to speak or not to speak, that is the question, as your great poet puts it.
What on earth are you talking about?
The most serious of all things hangs in the balance.
And what is that?
A woman's happiness. The moment has come, and I do not know what to do.
I see. By the way, Lawrence asked me to tell you he thinks he's found the extra coffee cup.
Ah, that is good. He has more intelligence than would appear, this long-faced Monsieur Lawrence. Now, there is something on which I need your opinion. Are you a good judge of finger marks?
Well, I know that none are ever alike.
Then take a look at these. I have numbered the photographs 1, 2, and 3. Will you describe them to me?
Number 1, I would guess, is a man's fingerprint, that of the index finger. Number 2 is a lady's, quite different in every way. Number 3, well, it's all rather confused, but there are 2 very distinct prints which appear to be the same as the man's finger in number 1.
You are sure of that?
As sure as I can be.
Good. Now, number 1 is the fingerprint of Lawrence Cavendish. Number 2, that of Mademoiselle Cynthia. And number 3 is the highly magnified surface of a small bottle in the poison cupboard of the dispensary at Tadminster.
You mean you deliberately went there when you knew Cynthia Murdoch wouldn't be around? But Lawrence was never near the poison cupboard on the day we were there. We stayed together all the time.
Are you certain of that?
No, I remember now. Cynthia and I were having tea out on the balcony, and she suddenly realised Lawrence wasn't with us and called out to him to join us. But it could only have been for a moment.
Long enough.
Long enough for what?
Long enough for a man who had once studied medicine to gratify a very natural interest.
What was in that particular bottle?
Hydrochloride of strychnine.
Good Lord.
There is far too much strychnine in this case. Strychnine in Mrs. Inglethorpe's tonic, strychnine sold across the counter to someone wearing a false beard, and now we have a strychnine bottle handled by Lawrence Cavendish. It is all very confusing. And as you know, I do not like confusion. Entrez.
I hope you will forgive my intruding, but they told me that you were here with Monsieur Poirot, Captain Hastings, and I thought I would call for you.
Oh, madame, I hoped you had called to honour me with a visit.
I would be only too happy to come whenever you wish.
If you should ever need a father confessor, madame, remember that Papa Poirot is always at your service.
I won't forget, Monsieur Poirot. Will you walk back with us to Stiles?
I should be enchanted, madame.
The weather had broken, and it felt more like autumn than early summer. Mary shivered and buttoned her coat close. As we went through the great door of Stiles, we came upon Dorcas. She was trembling and very pale.
They've arrested him, ma'am. They've arrested Mr. Cavendish.
They've arrested Lawrence?
No, sir, not Master Lawrence. Master John.
John?
I just can't believe it. After what you said about the strychnine bottle, I was certain it must be Lawrence. But John, my old friend John.
Every murderer is probably someone's old friend.
I must say, you might have given me a clue.
Perhaps I did not do so simply because he was your old friend. Did you never suspect him at all?
Never.
Did you not realise that if it was not her husband whom Mrs. Inglethorpe was quarrelling with that afternoon, it must have been either Lawrence or John?
And it was John. Is that what you're saying?
Why else should Mary Cavendish have pretended not to remember the conversation at the inquest?
Do you think they'll find him guilty?
On the contrary, I think there is a chance he may be acquitted. But I cannot be certain. It is one thing to know that a man is guilty, but it is quite another matter to prove him so. I lack the last link in the chain, and I do not know where to look for it.
Did that mean Poirot believed John to be guilty or not? It was 2 months before John was committed for trial at the Old Bailey, and during those weeks all my admiration and sympathy went out to Mary Cavendish. All thoughts of leaving John had been cast aside. She was determined to fight for him tooth and nail.
Yes, she is one of those women in whom adversity brings out the best. Her jealousy and her pride.
But her jealousy?
Have you not realised that she is a passionately jealous woman? But now she thinks only of her husband and of the terrible fate that is hanging over him.
Of course, he wouldn't tell me why she was jealous. It was another of those little mysteries Poirot persisted in keeping to himself. By the time the case came into court, I had been given a job at the War Office. Mary had taken a house in Kensington and invited Poirot and myself to stay with her. On September the 15th, John appeared in the dock to answer the charge of the willful murder of Emily Inglethorpe. Mr. Phillips opened for the Crown.
Rarely in the course of my career have I been confronted with a more ruthless or cold-blooded crime. The callous and deliberate poisoning, gentlemen of the jury, of a fond and trusting woman by a stepson to whom she had been more than a mother, who had supported him ever since his boyhood, a kind and generous benefactress to both the prisoner and his wife.
Mr. Phillips, a KC of the old school, began to build up a formidable and rather alarming case for the Crown.
I shall call witnesses to show that the prisoner, a profligate and spendthrift, had been at the end of his financial tether and, furthermore, had been carrying on an intrigue with the wife of a neighbouring farmer, a certain Mrs. Ricks.
No wonder poor Mary was so wretchedly unhappy.
This having come to Mrs. Inglethorpe's ears, she confronted the prisoner on the afternoon before her death, and a bitter quarrel ensued, part of which was most fortunately overheard. On the day previous to this, the prisoner had purchased strychnine at the village chemist's, wearing a disguise by which he hoped to throw suspicion upon another. The man he believed stood between himself and his stepmother's fortune, her husband, Alfred Inglethorpe. Fortunately, Mr. Inglethorpe had an unimpeachable alibi.
Provided by Mrs. Rakes, who had evidently been rather free with her favours.
On the afternoon of July the 17th, immediately after the quarrel with her stepson, Mrs. Inglethorpe made a new will. A fragment of this was found in the ashes of a bedroom fire the following morning, but it was undoubtedly drawn up in favour of her husband. This will had been almost certainly destroyed by the prisoner, but little did he know that the deceased had already drawn up a will in favour of her husband at the time of her engagement, which she had evidently forgotten about.
He got himself into rather a tangle over the various wills, and it was with considerable relief that he came to the end of his exposition and called to the stand his first witness, Inspector Japp.
Acting on information received, I searched the prisoner's room during his temporary absence from the house. In his chest of drawers, hidden under a pile of underwear, we found first a pair of gold-rimmed pince-nez, similar to those worn by Mr. Inglethorpe, and secondly, this file.
And you will see, gentlemen of the jury, that the file is labelled strychnine hydrochloride poison. And I believe you came across another piece of vital evidence, Inspector.
A piece of blotting paper in Mrs. Inglethorpe's checkbook. On being reversed in a mirror, one could discern the words, "Everything of which I die possessed, I leave to my beloved husband, Alfred Inge."
Which proves beyond question that the destroyed will had been in favour of the deceased's husband.
The counsel for the defence, Sir Ernest Heavyweather, was renowned for his bullying tactics, but it took him quite an effort to make any impression on the imperturbable Jap.
Tell me, Inspector, what day did you say it was that you searched the defendant's room?
Tuesday, the 24th of July.
Exactly a week after the tragedy. And you say that you found the pince-nez and the phial of strychnine in the chest of drawers. Was the drawer unlocked?
Yes, it was.
Does it not strike you as unlikely that a man who is supposed to have committed murder should keep such incriminating pieces of evidence in an unlocked drawer where anyone could find them?
He was probably in a hurry.
But it was a whole week after the crime. He would have had ample time to take them out of the house and destroy them.
Perhaps.
There is no perhaps about it. would he or would he not have had time to take them out of the house and destroy them?
Yes.
Now, you say you found these things underneath a pile of underwear.
That is correct.
Heavy or light?
Heavy or light what?
Underclothing.
Heavy-ish.
Winter underclothing. Obviously, the defendant would not be likely to go to that drawer.
Perhaps not.
Kindly answer my question. Would the defendant, in the hottest week of an exceptionally hot summer, be likely to go to a drawer containing winter underclothing, yes or no?
No.
In that case, is it not possible, Inspector, that the articles in question might have been put there by a third person, and that the defendant was totally unaware of their existence?
I should not think it likely.
But it is possible.
Yes.
That is all.
There followed what seemed to be an interminable wrangle over the parcel containing the black beard sent by the theatrical costumiers.
I believe, Miss Howard, that it was you who found this sheet of brown paper.
Yes, I did.
And where did you discover it?
On top of a wardrobe.
On top of the prisoner's wardrobe?
I believe so.
Did you not find it yourself?
Yes.
Then you must know where you found it.
Yes, it was on top of Mr. Cavendish's wardrobe.
The prosecution then further established that an assistant at the costumiers had sent a black beard to a Mr. L. Cavendish on receipt of his letter and a postal order. Sir Ernest made short work of him.
And where was the letter sent from?
From Stiles Court.
The same address to which you sent the parcel?
Yes.
How do you know?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
How do you know that the letter came to you from Stiles Court? Did you notice the postmark?
No, but...
Did you keep the envelope?
No, I...
So you did not notice the postmark nor retain any proof of it. And yet you affirm so confidently that it came from Stiles. It might, in fact, have been any postmark.
I suppose it might.
In fact, the letter might have been posted from anywhere. From Wales, for instance.
The significance of that last question only became apparent when Lawrence Cavendish took the stand, for at the date when the beard had been ordered, he had in fact been in Wales.
Do I understand that you deny having sent an order for a black beard on the 25th of June?
I do.
Then how do you account for the fact that it was ordered in your name and sent in your name to Stiles?
I cannot account for it.
In the event of anything happening to your brother John, Mr. Cavendish, who will inherit Stiles Court? Answer my question, if you please.
I suppose I should.
What do you mean, you suppose? Your brother has no children. You would inherit, wouldn't you?
Yes.
That's better. Now, on Tuesday, the 17th of July, you went, I believe, to visit the dispensary at the Red Cross Hospital in Tadminster.
Yes.
Did you, while you happened to be alone there for a few seconds, unlock the poison cupboard and examine some of the bottles?
I may have done so.
I put it to you that you did.
Yes.
Did you examine one bottle in particular?
No. I do not think so.
Be careful, Mr. Cavendish. I am referring to a phial of hydrochloride of strychnine.
No, I am sure I didn't.
Then how do you account for the fact that you left the unmistakable imprint of your fingers on it?
I suppose I must have taken up the bottle.
I suppose so too. Did you abstract any of the contents of the bottle?
Certainly not.
Then why did you take it up?
I once studied as a doctor. Such things naturally interest me.
So, poisons naturally interest you, do they, Mr. Cavendish? But you waited until you were alone before gratifying this interest of yours?
Well, I...
I have nothing further to ask you, Mr. Cavendish.
He is a clever man, Sir Ernest.
Do you think he really believes Lawrence is guilty?
I do not think he believes anything. What he is trying to do is to create such confusion in the minds of the jury that they cannot be certain which of the brothers did it. He is trying to make out that there is as much evidence against Lawrence as there is against John. and I think he may well succeed.
But on the following day, when John took the stand, things began to go badly against him, particularly when he was asked why he did not come forward at the inquest to explain that it was he and not Alfred Inglethorpe who had been overheard quarrelling with his stepmother.
It never occurred to me that anyone could have mistaken my voice for that of Mr. Inglethorpe. I was told there had been a quarrel between him and my mother, and I simply did not think this had any connection with my own disagreement with her.
Not even when the housekeeper, Dorcas, repeated certain fragments of the conversation, fragments which you must certainly have recognised.
I did not recognise them.
You must have a curiously selective memory, Mr. Cavendish.
The fact is that we were both angry and said more than we meant. I paid very little attention to my mother's actual words.
Mr. Phillips's incredulous sniff was a triumph of forensic art. But then he drew John onto far more dangerous ground, the question of his alibi for the time when the person disguised as Inglethorpe had purchased strychnine from the chemist's shop.
Your explanation is that you had been summoned to a place called Marston's Spinney by an anonymous letter threatening blackmail.
That is correct.
And is this the letter in question?
Yes, that is the letter.
You have produced this very opportunely, Mr. Cavendish. Tell me, is there nothing familiar about the handwriting?
Not that I know of.
Do you not see it bears a remarkable resemblance to your own handwriting, ineptly disguised?
No, I do not think so.
I put it to you that this is your own handwriting.
I deny that absolutely.
Is it not a fact that at the time you claim to have been at this solitary and unfrequented spot, you were, in fact, in the chemist's shop at Stiles St. Mary, disguised as Alfred Inglethorpe, and that you purchased strychnine, signing the register in his name?
That is utterly false.
Then I will leave the remarkable similarity between this letter, the forged signature in the chemist's poison book, and this specimen of your own handwriting to the consideration of the jury.
The case was adjourned until the following Monday. When they got back to the house, Poirot waved aside Mary's offer of a cup of tea and went straight upstairs. After a while, I followed him, and to my utter amazement, found him building a house of cards.
No haste, Deans. I am not yet in my second childhood. Sherlock Holmes had his violin. I have my house of cards. It requires precision of the fingers, and with precision of the fingers comes precision of the brain, and never have I needed it more than now.
You've certainly got a remarkably steady hand. It's almost as if you were performing a conjuring trick.
I need a steady hand, mon ami. The slightest tremble would bring the whole house tumbling down.
I've only seen your hand shake once.
On an occasion when I was enraged, perhaps.
You certainly were. It was when you found that the dispatch box in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room had been forced open. You stood by the mantelpiece, fiddling with the spill vases, and your hand was shaking like a leaf.
Oh, mon Dieu!
What's the matter?
It is that I have an idea. A stupendous idea. And you, my friend, have given it to me.
Steady on.
Where can I find a garage?
Why do you want a garage?
I must return to Stiles at once.
I've had a telegram from Monsieur Poirot. He says we must all return immediately to Stiles. Everyone who was in the house at the time of the murder must be present.
What on earth for?
He wants to hold a little reunion, as he puts it. Even Inspector Japp has been invited.
Ours not to reason why, I suppose. There's no point in trying to argue with him when he's like this, and even less point in asking him what it's all about.
Now, Miss Howard, if you will kindly sit here.
Wherever you like. What's all this in aid of?
All will be revealed in good time. And you next to her, Mademoiselle Cynthia?
Certainly, Monsieur Poirot. This is all rather exciting.
And the good Dorcas will sit here. And Annie, will you please sit next to her? And if you would be so good as to sit here, Madame Cavendish.
Of course.
And you next to her, Monsieur Laurence.
Whatever you wish.
I'll sit over by the window if it's all the same with you. Don't want to cramp your style.
But you must all be patient for a little while longer. We must delay the proceedings until Monsieur Inglethorpe arrives.
If that man comes into this room, I leave it.
Ah, but, mademoiselle, it is most important that you remain here. You wish to see your dear friend, Madame Emily, revenged, do you not?
Well, if you put it like that.
A few minutes later, Alfred Inglethorpe arrived.
I understand you've organised a little get-together, monsieur.
Poirot ushered him to his seat and then turned to his little audience with the complacent air of a popular lecturer.
Mesdames, messieurs, as I am sure you all know, I was called in to investigate this case by Mr. John Cavendish. There were two questions to be resolved. How did Mrs. Inglethorpe die and why?
There's no mystery about that. She was poisoned by her husband for her money.
Monsieur Poirot, we know that you have a great reputation in Belgium as a detective, but we have been at the Old Bailey for a week being questioned and cross-questioned. Why do we have to go through it all again?
Because, Mr. Inglethorpe, we still have to arrive at the truth. Now, let us go back to the beginning.
If we must.
My first action on coming to Stiles was to examine the bedroom of the deceased. I found first a fragment of green material, secondly, a stain on the carpet near the window, and thirdly, an empty box which had contained bromide powders. To take the fragment of green material first, I found it caught in the bolt of the door communicating between the room and the adjoining one occupied by Mademoiselle Cynthia. It was a piece torn from a land worker's green armlet.
It must have been yours, Mary. You're the only one on the land.
And it could mean only that Mrs. Cavendish had entered Mrs. Inglethorpe's bedroom through the room of Mademoiselle Cynthia.
But the door was always kept bolted on the inside.
It would have been easy enough for Mrs. Cavendish to unbolt it earlier and then to slide the bolt back in the confusion around Mrs. Inglethorpe's deathbed. Now, at the inquest, Mrs. Cavendish, you declared, did you not, that you had heard from your room in the left wing the fall of the table by Mrs. Inglethorpe's bed?
Yes, I did.
I took the opportunity of testing that statement by stationing my friend Hastings outside the door of your room while I was showing Inspector Japp the scene of the crime.
And you proceeded to knock over a table by the bed. A clumsy accident, you said at the time.
So that's what it was about. And of course I didn't hear a thing.
This confirmed my suspicion that Mrs. Cavendish was not in her bedroom at the time of the tragedy, but was actually in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room.
I looked at Mary. Never had I seen her so proudly beautiful. It was inconceivable that she could have murdered Mrs. Inglethorpe. And then I remembered once again the gleam in her wonderful, tawny eyes when she'd said that poison was a woman's weapon.
So, let us assume that Mrs. Cavendish is in her mother-in-law's room under the impression that she is sleeping peacefully. She is searching for something. Suddenly, Mrs. Inglethorpe wakes and is seized by an alarming paroxysm. She flings out her arm, overturning the bedside table, and then pulls desperately at the bell. Thoroughly alarmed, Mrs. Cavendish drops her candle and the grease spills onto the carpet. She picks it up and retreats back to the room of Mademoiselle Cynthia, closing the door behind her.
You mean she didn't lift a finger to help poor Emily?
Patience, mademoiselle. Mrs. Cavendish hurries out into the passage, but already the footsteps of the servants are echoing along the gallery. Quickly, she goes back into the young girl's room and starts to shake her awake while the servants are battering on Mrs. Inglethorpe's door. When Mr. Lawrence discovers her there, she joins the others, and it occurs to no one that she has not arrived with the rest of the family. Am I right, madame?
Yes, Monsieur Poirot, you are quite right. You must understand that if I'd thought it would do my husband any good to reveal these facts, I would have done so.
It showed a callous disregard for my poor wife's suffering.
But what I don't understand is why I didn't wake up while all this was going on.
Because you had been drugged, mademoiselle.
Drugged?
And with this in mind, I examined all the coffee cups from which everyone had drunk that evening, remembering that it was Mrs. Cavendish who had given you your coffee. I took a sample from each cup. But I had made a serious miscalculation.
You hadn't realised that Dr. Baustein was there that evening, so there were 7 cups instead of 6.
So the missing cup could only be Cynthia's.
Oh, I know, because I'm the only one who doesn't take sugar.
But then, My attention was caught by something you said, Annie. That there was a substance that looked like salt on Mrs. Inglethorpe's cocoa tray. Accordingly, I sent a sample of the cocoa to be analysed.
But Dr. Barstein had already done that, hadn't he?
Aha, but he had asked the analyst to look for traces of strychnine. I wanted to find out whether it contained a narcotic.
And, of course, it did.
You had administered a safe but effective narcotic, both to Mademoiselle Cynthia's coffee and to Mrs. Inglethorpe's cocoa.
You can imagine my feelings when the poor soul died in agony and everyone said she'd been poisoned. It was the most awful hour of my life, and I shall never forget it. Now I understand why you offered your services as a father confessor, Monsieur Poirot. I should have told you everything.
So now we are able to explain why the symptoms of strychnine poisoning took so long to make their appearance.
You mean that the drugged cocoa taken on top of the poisoned coffee would have delayed its effect?
Exactly, Monsieur Laurence. But we come now to a little difficulty. Mrs. Inglethorpe never drank her cup of coffee. Do you remember the stain on the carpet of Mrs. Inglethorpe's room? It was still damp and smelled strongly of coffee. I realized what must have happened when I put my little case on the table near the window and it instantly tipped up. The same thing must have happened when Mrs. Inglethorpe put her coffee down on it. And so, she heated up her cocoa instead.
So she never drank any coffee at all?
No. And yet the strychnine must have been administered between 7 and 9 that evening.
So, how was it done?
Through a substance so suitable for disguising its taste that it is extraordinary that no one thought of it. Her mitten.
You mean the murderer introduced the strychnine into her tonic?
No, no. There was no need for that.
Her tonic already contained strychnine. I pointed that out at the inquest.
And it was perfectly harmless. But when a bromide is introduced into the mixture, the strychnine will be precipitated and collect at the bottom of the bottle, and the last dose will contain all of it and prove fatal.
So those bromide powders I made up for...
were added to her medicine. But you were not to know that they were to be used in that way.
No. I had no idea they could have that effect.
And the person who habitually poured out Mrs. Inglethorpe's medicine was always careful not to shake the bottle so as not to disturb the deadly sediment at the bottom.
Quite ingenious, really, when you think about it. But please go on, Monsieur Poirot.
Throughout the case, there have been indications that the tragedy was intended to take place on the Monday evening. Mrs. Inglethorpe's bell wire had been severed. Mademoiselle Cynthia was spending the night with friends.
So she would have been quite alone in her room in the right wing, completely cut off from everyone. She would have died long before medical help could have reached her.
And there would have been no one to observe the unmistakable effects of the strychnine poisoning.
Exactly. But on that Monday night, in her hurry to be on time for the concert, Mrs. Inglethorpe forgot to take her medicine.
Oh, she didn't forget it, sir. I told her she ought to take it, but she said it would do her no harm to go without it for once.
And alas, she was right. For by not taking that last fatal dose until the following evening, she prolonged her life for another 24 hours, and it is to the events of those 24 hours that I shall now turn.
Is this really necessary? None of it's getting us anywhere.
It is necessary, Mr. Inglethorpe, and as you will see, it is getting us somewhere. Let us now consider the matter of the will.
Was it the will you were looking for in Emily's room, Mary? Did you destroy it?
No, I wasn't looking for the will, Lawrence. And the only person who could have destroyed it was Mrs. Inglethorpe herself.
That's ridiculous. I thought she was supposed to have made it on the afternoon before her death. You can't tell me she destroyed it on the same day.
Nevertheless, mademoiselle, that is what happened. How else can you account for the fact that on one of the hottest days of the year, Mrs. Inglethorpe ordered a fire to be lit in her room?
No.
Stands out like a sore thumb, really.
Mrs. Inglethorpe would have ordered a fire only because she wanted to destroy something so that no one would ever see it and could think of no other way. In fact, Hastings and I found a charred fragment of it in the ashes of her fireplace.
But why should she destroy a will she'd only just made?
That is what I asked myself. I thought at first it was the consequence of the quarrel she had had earlier that afternoon, but now I realize I was wrong. Can you remind us, Dorcas, of what you overheard your mistress say?
She said, "You need not think that any fear of publicity, of scandal between husband and wife, will deter me."
Those words were addressed not to Mr. Inglethorpe, as you supposed, but to her stepson, John Cavendish. And now, will you tell us what she said to you an hour later?
I've had a great shock, she said to me. I don't know what to do. Scandal between a husband and wife is a terrible thing, Dorcas. And she was holding a piece of paper in her hand.
But this second scandal she spoke of was not the same as the scandal with which she had confronted John Cavendish earlier that afternoon. Then she had been speaking of his liaison with Mrs. Raikes, but now she was referring to a scandal which concerned herself. What did she do then?
She ordered me to light the fire in her room.
So, let us reconstruct what happened. At 4 o'clock, Mrs. Inglethorpe quarrels with her stepson and threatens to tell his wife about the affair with Mrs. Raikes. I believe you overheard the greater part of that conversation, madame.
Yes, I did. And you can understand why I chose to say nothing about it.
Immediately afterwards, Mrs. Inglethorpe makes a new will in favour of her husband, cutting out John Cavendish. But then, at 5, she tells Dorcas to light a fire so that she can destroy the will she has just made.
So what happened in between, do you reckon?
I believe that Mrs. Inglethorpe had been anxious to send the new will off to her lawyers immediately, but she had no stamps. In the corner of her room stood her husband's desk. It was locked, but she had a key and opened it. In searching for the stamps, she came across a sheet of paper that she was never meant to see. This was the paper that Dorcas saw her holding in her hand shortly afterwards, and this, I believe, Mrs. Cavendish, was what you were searching for in her room on the night of her death.
I was certain that it was a letter from Mrs. Raikes to my husband. Mrs. Inglethorpe told me that it had nothing to do with him, but I didn't believe her.
So, what was this paper?
It was a letter written in haste by the murderer to his accomplice when he realized that Mrs. Inglethorpe's death would take place 24 hours later than they had planned. I will read it to you. Dearest Evelyn, you will be anxious about hearing nothing. It is all right, only it will be tonight instead of last night. There's a good time coming once the old woman is dead and out of the way. No one can possibly bring the crime home to me. That idea of yours about the bromide was a stroke of genius, but we must be careful. One false step... Here the letter breaks off, but there is...
You devil! How did you get hold of it?
I don't think that need concern us now, Mr. Inglethorpe. There's a Black Maria outside. We don't want to keep it waiting, do we? You do, Miss Howard.
The moment I set eyes on you, I knew you were going to be trouble, you little egg-shaped monster!
So did you really suspect Inglethorpe from the word go, Monsieur Poirot?
Oh, yes. There was no getting away from the fact that whoever stood to gain from his wife's death, he would benefit the most. I had no idea how the crime had been committed, but from what I knew of Mr. Inglethorpe, it would be very difficult to connect him with it. And then, when I began to investigate the Mrs. Raikes affair, my suspicions became a certainty.
How do you mean?
If he had been seriously involved with her, his stubborn silence at the inquest would have been perfectly comprehensible. But when I discovered that it was known all over the village that it was John Cavendish who was enamoured of the pretty lady, Inglethorpe's behaviour took on a very different meaning. It was nonsense to pretend that he was afraid of a scandal, and so I was forced to the conclusion that by constantly refusing to say where he had been when the strychnine was purchased, he was doing his utmost to get himself arrested. And from that moment, I was equally determined that he should not be.
But why on earth should he want to be arrested?
Because we have a very curious law in this country that if a man is once acquitted of a crime, he can never be tried again for the same offence. And if it hadn't been for Monsieur Poirot, I should have fallen headlong into the trap. I would have arrested Inglethorpe, he would have revealed his irreproachable alibi, and he would have been safe for life.
But even so, he was actually seeing Mrs. Raitt.
Oh, yes, yes. They took harmless little walks together along the lanes at times when Inglethorpe particularly wanted to establish an alibi for himself.
Like the time he was supposed to have bought the strychnine from the chemist's shop.
But I still don't see how he managed that. I mean, how could he be in two places at once?
Oh, is it possible? My poor friend, have you not realized it was Miss Howard who went to the chemist's shop?
Miss Howard? In that black beard?
Who else? She is of a similar height. Her voice is rather manly. And remember that she and Inglethorpe are cousins, and that there is a distinct resemblance between them.
And do you think the use of the bromide really was her idea?
I am inclined to think she was the mastermind in the whole affair, and had been planning Mrs. Inglethorpe's murder from the moment she first arrived at Stiles. I fancy that she and Inglethorpe were already passionately involved with one another.
So, all she had to do was to introduce him into the household at Stiles and let him work his wicked will on Mrs. Inglethorpe.
Poor Emily. She saw herself as such a forceful character, but underneath it all she was lonely and terribly gullible.
But would Evelyn Howard really have the medical know-how to set up the poisoning?
Oh, no special knowledge was needed, my friend. All that she had to know, she could have picked up from one of Lawrence Cavendish's medical textbooks. She knew that Mrs. Inglethorpe had a box of bromide powders and would occasionally take one at night. What could be easier than to dissolve one of them in her bottle of medicine?
And by the time Mrs. Inglethorpe had swallowed the last fatal dose, Miss Howard would have engineered her silly quarrel with her and left the house.
Ah, yes, it was a clever idea. And if they had left it alone, the murder would probably never have been linked to them.
What do you mean, if they left it alone?
They wanted a scapegoat and decided to throw suspicion on John Cavendish. That is the sole reason for Evelyn Howard putting on the black beard and obtaining the strychnine.
So that she could sign Inglethorpe's name in John's handwriting.
I presume it must also have been Miss Howard who wrote the note telling Cavendish to go to Martin Spinney, or wherever it was.
And again, she wrote it in his handwriting.
But then all their careful planning was thrown into confusion because Mrs. Inglethorpe did not take her medicine on the night they had calculated she would.
Even so, it was pretty stupid of Inglethorpe to write that letter.
I think his wife actually came into the room while he was writing it. He slipped it into his desk and went off for a walk.
And it was only by the merest chance she happened to find it. Poor Emily. It must have been a terrible shock for her.
I suppose Inglethorpe couldn't have realised it was missing until after her death. But how on earth did he know where she'd put it?
She always kept personal and important documents in her dispatch case. Just imagine the feelings of Mr. Inglethorpe the following morning when he hears that John Cavendish and Mr. Wells are to examine the contents of the case and that I have the key. He panics and breaks it open. Every moment is vital. So what do you think he does with the letter?
I am the foggiest.
Do not forget, the fire is not lit, so he cannot burn it. Instead, he tears it. He tears it into long, thin strips, rolls them into spills, and puts them among the others in the jars on the mantelpiece.
Oh, however did you work that out?
So you, mon ami.
Me?
Yes, you told me that my hands were shaking after I discovered that Mrs. Inglethorpe's dispatch case had been broken into and that I was straightening the spill jars on the mantelpiece. But then, you see, I remembered that I had already straightened them earlier that morning. So, someone else must have moved them.
And that is why you rushed back to Stiles.
So you see, Captain Hastings, we owe it all to you.
But I'd better be off. I must see these precious cousins off to their respective jails. Thank you, Monsieur Poirot. Once again, you've saved me from making an ass of myself.
I do think you might have given me a few hints instead of leading me up the garden path like that.
Oh, I did nothing of the kind, mon ami. At most, I permitted you to deceive yourself.
But why?
Because you have a nature so honest and a countenance so transparent that if I told you my ideas the very first time you looked upon Alfred Inglethorpe, that astute gentleman would, in your charming English phrase, have smelt a rat.
I think I have more diplomacy than you give me credit for.
Oh, no, do not enrage yourself, my friend. Your help has been most invaluable. It is but your beautiful nature that gave me pause.
I still think you might have given me a few clues. As it was, you left me to flounder about on my own, suspecting practically everybody. Bauerstein, Mary Cavendish, Lawrence, well, particularly Lawrence. After all, he was behaving very strangely.
You realize, of course, what was behind all that?
No.
Well, you did not see that he believed Mademoiselle Cynthia to be guilty of the crime?
But that's ridiculous.
No, not in the least. The possibility was in my mind when I asked Mr. Wells about the provisions of the will. And it was Mademoiselle Cynthia who made up the bromide powders. Shall I tell you what made Monsieur Laurence turn so pale when he first entered his dying stepmother's room?
What?
He saw that the door into Mademoiselle Cynthia's room was unbolted.
But he swore it was bolted.
Exactly. And that confirmed my suspicion that it was not. He could not have realized that Mary Cavendish had opened it. He believed that Cynthia had done so, and he was determined to shield her.
But why?
Because he is in love with her.
Oh, no, Poirot, you're quite wrong there. I know for a fact that he doesn't care for her at all.
Who told you that?
Cynthia herself.
They are like that, les femmes. Why else did he grind Mrs. Inglethorpe's coffee cup into the floor with his heel? Because he suspected that Mademoiselle Cynthia may have had something to do with the poisoning, and he was determined there should be no chance of analyzing its contents.
Ah, was that why he kept on insisting that his stepmother had died from natural causes?
Of course. Ah. He hoped, as a trained doctor, his opinion might carry some weight.
And what about the extra coffee cup you wanted him to find?
I was fairly certain that Mary Cavendish had hidden it to conceal the fact she had put a sleeping draught into Mademoiselle Cynthia's coffee. If I could prove that, then the young lady would be in the clear.
Well, I'm glad it's all ended happily. Even John and Mary seem to be reconciled.
And they have me to thank for that.
You?
What, do you not realize it was the trial that brought them together again? I was convinced that John Cavendish loved his wife and she him, but they had drifted far apart. You remember the day of John Cavendish's arrest when you found me deliberating over a major decision?
Yes, but I had no idea what it was all about.
I was trying to decide whether or not I should clear John Cavendish at once.
You mean you could have saved him from being brought to trial at all?
Oh, yes, my friend. But in the end, I decided in favor of a woman's happiness. Nothing but the great danger through which they have passed could have brought these two proud souls together again.
I looked at him with silent amazement, the colossal cheek of the man. Who but Poirot would have thought a trial for murder would restore conjugal happiness?
One moment, Hastings. Do you see, over there by the fountain,
Lawrence and Cynthia. Good Lord, she's kissing him. And he's kissing her.
So perhaps he does not dislike her quite as much as she supposed.
They make a pretty pair, don't they? Thank goodness they've realized at last what was obvious to the rest of us.
It wasn't obvious to me.
I'm going back to London. Inspector Japp says John will be set free tomorrow morning. Thank you, Monsieur Poirot. Without you, he would be facing the gallows.
I am happy to have been of service, madam.
And thank you, Captain Hastings. You helped me through my darkest hour. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Ah, mon pauvre ami. You were in love with both of them, were you not?
Yes, they were two delightful women.
console yourself, mon cher Hastings. One day this terrible war will be over, and we will hunt together again. And then, who knows what the future will bring.
In Agatha Christie's The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat, Captain Hastings, Simon Williams. Detective Inspector Japp, Philip Jackson. Emily Inglethorpe, Jill Balkan. Alfred Inglethorpe, Hugh Dixon. Evelyn Howard, Nicola McAuliffe. John Cavendish, Sean Arnold. Mary Cavendish, Susan Jameson. Lawrence Cavendish, Nicholas Bolton. Cynthia Murdoch, Annabelle Dowler. Dorcas, Hilda Schroeder. Dr. Bauerstein, Robert Portal. Mr. Wells, Richard Sims. The Coroner, Peter Howell. Mr. Mace, Harry Myers. Inspector Summerhayes, Don McCorkindale. Mr. Phillips, Johan Meredith. Sir Ernest Heavyweather, Michael Mears. The Costumier's Assistant, Richard Katz. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The music was composed by Tom Smale. The Mysterious Affair at Stiles was dramatized by Michael Bakewell and directed by Enid Williams.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.